Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom." And with all that getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there, or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcast of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the B.B. Toomey. Interesting things put in the marketplace all the time. African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:08 here in the city of Philadelphia on a Sunday evening, warm Sunday evening. And we'll be in conversation this evening. Get a little update from two brother activists down in Baltimore that's been on the program before, but it's been a while since they've been on. And I'm glad to have them back, activist organizers of the Ujima People's Progress Party. Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi will be joining us. We're going to touch on some of the things that the party is currently doing and things that has been happening since the police murder of George Floyd. And then we'll discuss some other topics related to our struggle and what Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi have been doing in regards to the Independent Black Political Party down there in Baltimore. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and R Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Ellie.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm just cruising, looking forward to our discussion as always. I think this is another one of those critical moments where we have to have political education class going on. And I believe Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi, will help us in exploring, our own centering our party formation and our policy development and just where we are in this moment. So I'm really looking forward to that kind of discussion.
It's kind of funny that that you mentioned that, Richard, because, I mean, we've been talking about this for a while. Brother Namdi and Brother Brandon have been on previously, maybe on a couple of occasions, and we've had black independent parties from different areas of the country that have been on. And you see now what a lot of these things going on centered around the murder of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Sister Breonna Taylor, that a lot of these other people now is trying to make political moves in reference to this.
It raises a question, really serious question about now.
I know it, but we'll talk about some of that with our special guest tonight, activist and organizer of the Ujima People's Progress Party down in Baltimore, Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi. And they should be with us here on the line. If I can get these papers together on my desk, stuff falling all over the place. Let me get them on. Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi.
Hey, do you hear me?
I hear you, Brandon. Is that you? It sounds like you're in a truck.
Yeah.
Brother Namdi, are you with us?
I am, brother. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're in a quiet place, Brother Brandon. He got a lot going on.
There's always a lot going on.
I know it. He's on the move. I'd let both of y'all stay on the move. I'm glad to have you back with us to talk about some of the things that you've been doing down there as far as organizing. In fact, when I talked to Brandon, he was on his way back from Pennsylvania, and I'm quite sure he was doing some organizing wherever he was. So, brothers, talk about the party. Talk about some of the things that y'all have been doing in the community, some of the grassroots efforts that y'all have been doing in the community here recently since the last we talked. And talk about some of the things going on now centered around a lot of these protests around the murders of unarmed black people, and just recently George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Sister Breonna Taylor. Brother Namdi, go ahead. Or Brandon, whoever wants to start.
Let me go ahead and start, brother.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, first, just to let your audience just get a quick update on who we are. Mm-hmm. The Ujima People Progress Party is a party in Maryland working to actually gain ballot access as Maryland's first black workers-led electoral party for social justice and economic justice. We think it's important that African people get out of parties that are white supremacist, imperialist, capitalist, racist parties that do not represent our best interests or the interests of human beings throughout the world. And one of the ways to do that is to create your own independent party with a platform that speaks to you, to your community, and allows us to organize ourselves not just during voting time, but throughout the course of the year, 365 days. Where we can strategize about the economic and political strategies that we need. And in doing that, the base of what we do isn't, running candidates in elections. It's about being involved with community struggles, being involved with building institutions that black working class people start with our own resources and run, that we teach to each other so that we can have as much self-reliance and self-determination as we possibly can. Our interest, even in the electoral process, is to build power. Some people get into elections because they think that winning an office will transform what happens in our community. But the fact is that the real transformation happens when people are in motion and we have power over our own lives, right, to solve our own issues.
Okay.
So that's pretty much who we are. And in that context, a lot of the work that we've been involved with, especially around since the COVID-19 issue, has been to help the community really solve its own problems. We've had this issue of food deserts that have always existed since we've moved into these cities and we've lost our economic institutions to take care of ourselves. We have whole pockets of areas where it's really difficult to get fresh food, to get food that's healthy. When the COVID-19 came down, they put the stay-at-home command to stop the spread. But then at the same time, you had whole neighborhoods, especially poor working communities, housing projects where folks just didn't have access to food. So how do they get it, right? Riding the bus is dicey, especially in the beginning when people weren't clear about what protocols to do. The city attempted to run off attempts of people who normally help with food, bringing it to areas in need. So we took up the struggle, supported residents in the Douglas Home community area, led by Sister Reverend Annie Chambers, who's a tremendous fighter for working people, and was able to start organizing people from throughout the community to help with really not just food, providing food, but food sovereignty, right? To be able to guarantee that we could have access to food, quality food, food that was relevant to our community. And that has also grown into helping residents now start to grow some supplies of food in their own windowsill so that they at least have access to small things that they need, from their own yard. So that was where we were before, the murders have activated our community. I'll stop right there.
Brandon, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, so we were speaking particularly about the food project and the food sovereignty that was going on in the community and being able to speak candidly about that organizing as well. A part of it is the call for community control of public resources as well as community control of food, as Brother Namdi mentioned. If we're able to answer the question of food sovereignty and community control of food, then we come one step closer to sending a working class family, a poor working class black family to the market to be able to save funds and resources as well. We deal with that contradiction often where a person has to choose whether they're going to get a Uber or a Lyft from their home to the market and have to spend those resources closely aligned with buying overpriced products and as well as getting subpar groceries. And due to the fact that we're also dealing with the pandemic crisis in our time, it puts us at a huge disadvantage because if we're told to stay in our home, then we're also told to wait until food comes to us. And if the city itself is distributing those resources, most likely a city that overpays its police department and undercompensates its education system will take shortcuts and they'll take compromises on what's important. So we will not be receiving fresh foods, but instead the recycled foods between school lunches, which they give to our children, and also which they feed the correctional officers in schools. So it has to be a clear understanding that the power we're building between fight back programs and community control of food, housing, education, the police, and energy, as well as employment and healthcare, is all also tied to the independent political power that goes into building a black base that does not have to win elections or get voted into office to make a difference.
Brother Brandon, Brother Namdi, do you find since last year when you had the convention down there and making people aware that the party existed and how they can get involved, what has been the process or movement as far as being able to put the party on a ballot where people could cast their ballots in reference to some of the candidates running?
Yeah.
Or do you have to write it in? Can it still be written in, or does it have to be physically put on the already put on the ballot?
So Maryland's slightly different than Pennsylvania in the sense that they don't allow for a municipal party. Either you have total state recognition or you have no recognition as a party.
Okay.
Coming off our conference, it allowed us to start trying to build a broader network of organizers in different parts of the state. And so really part of our strategy has always been to not just be, like I said, to be a really active party, but for people to relate to it, similar somewhat to how there are people right now who do all kind of jobs in the community, educators, medical field, stay-at-home moms and dads, whatever it is that they do, but they might have a Democrat registration in their back pocket. What we were trying to get people to understand is that enjoying the work to be a part of the Ujima People's Progress Party wasn't asking you to quit your organization and your goals and your activities, but to kind of build a network so that the party would be active all throughout the state in the different types of work that we always do as organizers and activists. And to be able to leverage that so that if there's something happening on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, right, where black folks are in a minority, that's help could be, you know, be sent over from larger counties like Baltimore and Prince George's County and so forth, you know, be able to do resources, teach-ins, demonstrations, you know, whatever was necessary. And then that would be the real strength of it. And we start to see that really pay off for us. If not for the COVID-19 thing this year, we were in the process of starting to roll out a training of all the allies that we have built throughout the state. And we were going to launch our petition drive to get on the ballot. We need 10,000 signatures to do that. But obviously COVID-19 hit very early in the season and wiped that out. But the potential has only grown for us. I mean, the more we're out there, the more people know us. We have a national presence now with several organizations. So, you know, as soon as this is cleared up in the path to how we can get back in front of people, our goal is to be on the ballot in 2021 and be able to start running candidates wherever we need to.
That was my next question. Was there a required amount of signatures that you needed? But being both you men are active and some of your partners are active in the community, a lot of the community is already aware of you. So you don't think it'll be a problem to get the amount of signatures that's needed?
No. History has shown us that the problem is the organizers being consistent, the collective. So not that people won't sign it. We really never had a problem with people not signing.
Okay. Brother Richard?
You know, well, I appreciate the work that y'all are doing, and I'm going to use this as a reporting session, so I apologize if I'm off. I'm one of those people. I call myself a Marcus Garvey conservative, right? And I'm one of those people that have never, I think I've only voted one time, and that's when Wilson Good first ran for mayor.
Well, you say you think, Richard. Go ahead.
So I'm one of those people where voting has always been, well, I've always believed until black people can be able to do as you gentlemen are saying, create our own infrastructure to demonstrate our own power, it is kind of fruitless, or it's more entrepreneurship in relationship to the way I viewed it. But in this moment, I don't know if it's this age, and because, and as you mentioned, Pennsylvania, you know, I did join the New African Independence Party, which has, from a voting perspective, has a different dynamic, right? So when I ask my questions, I'm asking it from you are political party designers and looking at it from that point, because I think that each state and we need to create our own political party. So let me ask for the Ujima People's Progressive Party, what are you saying is the core values of the party?
Yes, I can answer this. So for us, we have, thanks for asking that too, Brother Richard. So we have an 11-point social justice and economic justice platform. They're all tied around pretty much the community control of resources and demands, but particularly we call for the right of ex-felons and those who are looking to return to the community to be able to have those resources at will, to be able to be gainfully employed and also have access to housing, transportation, healthcare, education, and also food as well. We also have the social justice and economic justice platform on there with the call for restoration, as well as abolishing the Maryland Law Enforcement Bill of Rights to be able to remove special immunities from police department that give officers 10 days to also work with interagencies between the sheriff's office, the MTA, to corroborate a story, to be able to submit testimony and theory that they have not committed any wrongdoing, despite what may be caught on camera by community witnesses as well. We also have on our social and economic justice platform that we are looking to launch the push for a livable wage, and as well as community control of housing, where the community themselves be able to determine their destiny on how they live, in which they're able to provide for themselves in such a way. inside of that platform, particularly, we also look for women's rights, women's empowerment, right, across our community, and also the ability to be able to have self-determination with it, and the call to be able to end unjust laws as well as racial discrimination and certain practices that are used by a capitalist institution with the methods of imperialism, that if we're not able to obtain it through economic means, we have to go through the Democratic or the Republican Party, but more so it's a Democratic stronghold. And if we're not willing to play along to get along, then we'll have to deal with the police department and all other elements as well. And finally, we also call for the demilitarization of the police department, because we're dealing with a spy plane that's being funded from a billionaire philanthropist in Texas using an ex-army colonel as well. So when we're dealing with Wall Street putting cameras in our community, philanthropists putting planes in our skies, we know that when we're out there demonstrating on behalf of the brothers that are arrested, political prisoners, and as well as sisters that are abused, more than likely we would have to be the ones to call for such a progressive movement that reforms itself with behalf measures. And inside of our platform, as you ask us about, Brother Richard, that 11 point, particularly around social and economic justice, we look to be able to distinguish ourselves as not just a Black party, but as an independent party that wins power back to the community through fight back programs and campaigns.
And I really appreciate that. And I'm glad to have heard that in the formation stage, you understand, you know, that you started from, I take it that's Baltimore City proper, and recognize you have to create network alliance throughout the state. And with that said, I don't know how Maryland is, you know, as far as the demographics, as it relates to African people, you know, Black people. But is it broken down into counties? And I'm saying this for the listening audience to understand, when we're talking about developing independent Black political parties, it's a lot that we have to consider in order to build that power base, right? And you gentlemen are actually engaged in that. So are we talking about counties, and is there certain pockets within Maryland that have a minority, what they call a majority minority base, like Baltimore City is, even though it's a majority African people, is considered a minority political franchise? If and y'all could correct me if I'm wrong in that characterization. Yeah. Is there other counties that you're looking, targeting as that Black population to meet the statewide party expansion?
Yeah, so we are in a very unique situation in Maryland. Maryland itself has the fifth highest ratio of African descendant people in the country. The 30% of the total population in Maryland is of African descent. And so that's a sizable number of people. And then you also talk about strongholds. The city of Baltimore City has about 65% Black population. Even larger than Baltimore is a county south of us, several counties south of us called Prince George's County, where you have about 60 to 65%. But the county itself is almost twice as big as Baltimore as well. So you're talking about a huge population. Prince George's County sits right on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. And so some of the Black flight out of D.C. over the last 20 years because of the rising cost of living has only increased the number of African people who now live in PG County. There are other several counties like Montgomery County, Baltimore County, which surrounds Baltimore City, where you have very large populations of African people as well. And then it starts to get a little more sparse when you're talking about on the edges, the Eastern Shore, which is like another time zone altogether, where actually Republicans dominate the politics of that region. And then in Western Maryland, in the mountains, Frederick, Hagerstown, those are much, you know, you're going to look at around 15 to 20%. Populations of African people. But again, as a statewide party, it's viable. But we understand that also the politics of local politics is that almost in every city, there is a quote-unquote black district, right,
mm-hmm.
where they've set aside, because of gerrymandering, districts that tend to favor black Democrats and liberals of that nature. And those are places that we think we need to contend. We deal with this question of the black misleadership class, if you're familiar with that.
Right.
These are black people who, in their role as junior partners to capitalism and to white supremacy, are elected officials. And in Baltimore, we've got black mayors and black city council presidents, and they run the agenda. But if you close your eyes and just, didn't look at the color of the officials, the policies are all white, about white supremacy. All the policies are about capitalism. All the policies are about kicking black people out, gentrification, more police, and no economic development in areas where black people live. So these are it's not tenable for us. And we need to help people understand their relationship, if not nationally, at least locally. That whenever you get your behind parts kicked, it's usually in most urban areas, it's usually a Democrat who's allowing that butt kicking to get done.
And that contradiction is definitely me and Elliot, really, he makes sure he emphasized that, especially as we look at Philadelphia. And I'm going to ask one more question in this round, pass it back over to Elliot. But I appreciate that your understanding of the demographic structure. That's important. And I want those in the listening audience, for us to understand that that's how we have to look at this. I think you would agree. I mean, from a sovereign thinking perspective, from a strategic perspective, those of us who want true, even as individuals who want true power, we have to start looking at where we live and how we arrange ourselves from this kind of formulation. Because if we don't, we won't make the kind of political choices that at least lets us move as a independent body, even if we don't have a party. And that raises my question here. Do you see that, I'm gonna call them clubs, over, especially based off after the last 5 years with Freddie Gray, has black political clubs in Baltimore grew? Meaning black political discussion, from 5 years ago to now, has it grown, which would help in dealing with the development of the UGMA People's Progressive Party?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And, that will also depend on exactly what will be the scope and the focus of the club per se. But since you highlighted in a specific way as far as a UGMA way, I would have to disagree, because the murder of Freddie Gray has happened to sprung about the nonprofit industrial complex, where the contradiction that many African Americans, but particularly many Africans and working class folks in the U.S. deal with, is that there's benefit in the pain not being resolved in their inner cities, state and counties and districts. And what that means is it will be much easier to set up a foundation, a charity, or an institution, plan a tool that can be used as a democratic machine or a democratic exactly repertoire at their cachet to be able to nullify the effects of how the police relationship to the community is not really a relationship, just nothing more but, an overlord or overbearing powership as well. And that, and those leagues, as well as organizations that do not necessarily address the quest for autonomy, self-determination, and real independent black political power. Because a lot of times, as we face it, a lot of folks will say, well, why would we, build or support an independent party and I can't vote in the primaries? And that being a tough question, where, the responses itself would carry over to, why wouldn't you want to build an independent black political party if you're a worker in the city or in the state of Maryland, that if the unemployment rate is at 8%, then that's double, than that. And as the numbers are being told, that for every 1% of a person that is on the unemployment rate, that's also considered a person that's potentially dying, because if you're not
that told the line between asking for concessions to certain politics that just keeps the status quo going and actually challenge the political establishment against the poverty pimping message and the plantation politics we see in place today.
You know, and Elliot, if I can, it's a paragraph that I seen. You know, we had Baba Dada on last week, and we're talking about independent parties,
mm-hmm.
You know, him coming out of SNCC, and it's a paragraph I seen. I wanted to share with you know, just to continue to set this framework up about how important it is and how powerful it is to have a independent political party. It's a couple of minutes just to go through that.
Go ahead.
But I think that set this up as far as why the Ujima People's Party, Progressive Party, is necessary and the potential it has, of all the independent parties we've had on and had the discussion about. And this is dealing with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And this out of Black Political Parties and Historical and Political Analysis by Haynes Walton Jr. And he says, SNCC radicals had risen to ascendancy after the 1964 Democratic National Convention. It was this group that dominated much of the party's ideology, rejected out of hand all coalitions with white liberals, and kept the Mississippi Democratic Party representation out of the Mississippi Democratic Committee, charging that the white allies had undermined the convention challenge, and that furthermore, the entire establishment was morally bankrupt. Sounds familiar? The SNCC faction determined that the party should adopt a go-it-alone program. Armed with such a program and an attendance ideology, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party emerged as the arch competitor of the NAACP and the state's only other predominantly Black organization in seeking the support of state newly enfranchised Negroes. And I just thought that you know, sets the understanding for us and SNCC and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party at that convention did get what they want. And Baba Dada made it clear to us, it wasn't the marches, it was the political positioning of the party that got that Voting Rights Act passed. I just wanted to share to, you know, with the listening audience what these men are doing, the power it has, and what we need to be looking at as we look in the areas from where we live.
Could I say something to Brother Richard?
Good. Yes, sir.
And I think something that you said earlier about what, you know, your voting habits and mm-hmm. and the question of building these types of institutions. I think it's anybody who's really clear about what's being done to Black people. There is no reason for most Black people to vote, not unless you are a sellout, right? Your allegiance, our allegiance as a people to the Democratic Party is destructive. And it really is being held together by miseducation and a carrot and stick type of relationship on the local level where resources are so denied to our people that you have to, you know, get along with the local machine to get a little piece. And Brother Brandon was talking about the nonprofit industrial complex that's really been built upon that kind of relationship. And because you know where your money comes from, you never buck. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And voting for people who honestly never have an agenda for us really does not serve our interests. I mean, literally, we know that in conversations, people talk about, you know, their concerns. We have to remind them that as I said, when police beat Black people, it ain't our party that's done it. It's been the Democratic Party. If Black people are not being educated, it's not our party that failed them. It's the Democratic Party. We have to help people understand that what we're building isn't just about winning elections. It's about having an institution, an instrument that can fight for our interests, right? And the brother so clearly laid out that the very right to vote was not gained because of the right to vote, right? It wasn't like we voted out the right to vote into office. It was all the political organizing, all the fight back, all the strategizing, all the resistance that we made that forced this government to have to recognize our right to vote And that's what we have to always stay clear on. If we're going to move our people forward around the economic and social justice question, we have to build power, and the machine to do that is a political party, and that's whether you vote or not.
Thank you for that clarity.
Brother Menotti, Brother Brandon, Richard, you mentioned in that passage you just read, where the author said that the efforts of SNCC was undermined by white allies.
Mm-hmm.
8 months before Dr. King died, he mentioned something similar in a speech when he said that the young black folks was booing him because he encouraged them to have faith in America and white society and have faith in people who have too often proved to be unfaithful. Now, these are words from Dr. King, a man that was encouraging people to get out there and march with white folks. Now, when you see, you men have been organizing down in Maryland for a while around these similar issues. In fact, one of the planks in your social justice is about community control of police. So when you see this incident happen with Brother Floyd, I mean, this is a regular occurrence, almost a weekly occurrence in the black community. But when you've seen white folks jump out there and start howling and screaming in the street, did it kind of surprise you? Or how did you take that?
Good question.
Brother Brandon, Brother Nami, either one.
Well, I will both try to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at that, it wasn't a surprise because we understand that a lot of the fragmented forces inside the U.S. are working class forces. So we wouldn't say the least that it would be just poor working class black folks in the street that's tied a relationship to the police and the institution. But being able to see that there are different forces from within and outside the community, we say that we put ourselves in a more prominent and promising position to lead those organizations, to be able to say that the difference between getting out on the street and saying Black Lives Matter and defund the police is being able to understand the relationship that the police has to the prison industrial complex. What is the relationship the prison industrial complex has to the military complex? And what does the military complex has to the war machine, as Dr. Martin Luther King has said as well, and the U.S. being the greatest purveyor of violence overall. And the reason why this has to be highlighted and put in such a contextual way and not to be overlooked or confused in no kind of way, form, shape, or fashion is simply because we are right now at a period where when we are witnessing folks from different parts of the community or different parts of the state come out and speak and take a stand, that is just one part of the struggle. The other part is being able to challenge the institution, because as it is always said, the police department, the prisons, the nonprofit industrial complex, they're all going to benefit from black suffering. And the contradiction to that is, why would they support an independent black political institution or party that is resistant to the status quo of Americanism and the violence itself? So we have to challenge those who are outside of the black community, the poor working class African community in Baltimore City, the state of Maryland, and across the nation, to be able to say that if we know the police institutions for planes, guns, automobiles, and bullets are going to be paid for through our tax dollars and used to oppress us and throw us in jail and put us in coffins faster, then what are you going to do to attack the institution of capitalism that's using the right arm of imperialism to be able to beat and oppress black people when we stand up against these forces, versus when white folks in the streets and organize, they're calling it peaceful demonstrations, but when black folks do peaceful demonstrations, they're often met with violence, as has been recorded throughout history. So there has to be a lot of politicizing, a lot of radicalizing the left that calls themselves the left of the institutions of the working class, but particularly it has to be led by a independent black political party that is inside the U.S. to be able to recognize those forces in the street calling for Black Lives Matter and showing them the difference between demonstrating your practice versus the theory of words.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'll just piggyback off of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should be surprised. We understand that capitalism in America is a dynamic thing, right? It's always changing. The generation of white people that we see today are probably one of the first, if not the second now generation, where they literally can't say for sure if their lives will be better than their parents. And so there's all this debt, all this crisis that they're now experiencing about uncertainty for jobs. I think also there's a cultural difference about how young white people experience the world differently than their parents. All that adds up to people, white people being in motion. But I think we also have to learn from our own history as well. And SNCC and even Malcolm X in later years help us to understand that the question of white people being involved in the struggle isn't a contradiction, unless can be a contradiction, unless we are clear about what our interests are when we deal with them.
Okay.
White people experience the world very differently than we do, right?
Right.
So, you know, they all say white workers unite. I mean, excuse me, workers of the world unite. That's great as a slogan. But when black workers are murdered in the street, lynched by not only the police, but reactionary white workers, when unemployment rates are different, when health conditions are staggeringly different, education, it's clear that there's a different experience for black workers than white workers. So when they engage and get involved, we have to be clear to educate them about what their role is, who the real leadership of these questions are. We have to make sure that they understand that some of the reforms that they think solve problems don't solve problems for us. It might alleviate some issues for them, but it doesn't go anywhere near to the core of what needs to be resolved by our community. And I think we have to be more political mature, right? I think in many ways, black people have been forced to only accept democratic politics as the only option. So it puts a certain kind of blindness on us. Matter of fact, we've had people like the mayor in Atlanta tell us, you know, don't, you know, when you protest, protest the right way and get them when it's time to vote. Well, that's coded language for vote for Democrats, right? And so white people don't have people admonishing them and telling them that the Democratic Party is the only option. Hell, they know that if they want to, they can go join the Republican Party next week if they really want to and start solving some of their problems any other, you know, through other options. So we have to be clear about when we see white people there, yeah, they're welcome to be in these demonstrations, but they can't lead movements. They can't speak for movements. And we have to also make sure that they cannot organize in our community. That's a huge contradiction because we can no longer tell white workers and white interests to solve our problems.
You know, I'm going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation. Well, let me say this before we break, because I want some of you men's opinions on this. Because if we notice generally, and I'll just use the term generally, in our communities, we're kind of unorganized to a certain extent. And when I say unorganized, it's always cadres of people that are organized in any black community, municipality, even rural areas. But they don't coalesce with one another. They don't form a fist. They're generally spread out. So when these things happen, we kind of have different objectives. It's similar objectives, but they're different, if you understand what I'm saying, and you men are organizers.
Yeah.
Well, with Europeans, generally, when they get involved in something, they already have their objective targeted. Now, I'll take whites that have been jumping out here, because I saw a report on the television, a news report, where some black activists in Seattle was upset with these whites that had taken over a portion of Seattle because they said that they're changing the narrative of what their objectives were. And if you notice, white folks all of a sudden, they got their fist in the air, the black power salute, hollering Black Lives Matter, George Floyd. Now, but you see behind the scenes, it's a LGBTQ contingent that's pushing this. They wanted to have a collaborative march with Black Lives Matter in Los Angeles and New York. I think they kind of backed off the one in Los Angeles. But we see where they had a objective or a narrative that they were pushing and using black people as the cannon fodder, so to speak, out front. Now you got a group of whites that are generally in these urban areas that are hollering defund the police. Now, I got my opinion on this. I'm going to throw it out. We're going to take a break and come back. And I wanted to get your men's opinions. Then we'll go to the phones. You got a lot of whites that have come into these urban areas, gentrifying these communities which were traditionally black. Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Baltimore is no exception. Washington, D.C., all of these areas. And prior to them coming in, these areas, urban areas where we live, was generally like small police states, over-policed. Money was flowing in to have police, police on top of police, doing whatever they wanted to do. And it was no money available for other things, for schools, for recreation centers. A lot of our recreation centers look like somebody threw a bomb in there. It's full of glass. The facilities where children can play, they can't play. You can't use the bathroom in a lot of these places. They're terrible, in terrible conditions. So all of a sudden, white folks is coming into these communities. And they find out that a lot of the funds that they can use, the public money, is being used towards the police. So certainly they have an objective saying that they want to defund the police because they want some of this money or a lot of this money to go towards refurbishing these schools where we have been going to for decades that's full of asbestos and falling apart. They want these schools redone. They want these rec centers redone. They want to build dog parks so they can take their dog for a walk. They want money for other things. They don't want money for policing because you don't see whites in these suburban areas talking about defund the police. It's only whites in these urban areas because they're in these urban areas now. And when they go downtown, Richard, and you know it, when they go downtown looking for money, money is allocated for the police.
Mm.
So they're out there with their own objective. They don't really care about the police abusing our people. Since George Floyd has been murdered, you done had three other murders. A 62-year-old man in Los Angeles, a disabled man. You had the brother last night, and then you had the brother doing Breonna Taylor's march. There was a restaurateur that used to feed the cops. They kill him and leave him in the street for 14 hours. So you done had three other murders since George Floyd. So to me, they have an objective. I want to see how you men feel about this. And we go see what the callers think about it. But I just threw that out there because a lot of times we find ourselves being that we're unorganized to a certain extent in some of these communities. We find ourselves playing checkers and these other people playing chess. And then the next thing you know, we're out of position and we don't understand why or we don't understand what happens until we get hit. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we'll continue the discussion. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with activists and organizers of UGMA, People's Progress Party. Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi is with us. Get involved in the conversation. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometz U Black family, to join your interconnected Kometz U Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
That this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. The brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda. Thank you.
We have a message to the black man, because the black man today is a man who has been made now almost into a laughing stock. Nobody takes the black man serious. We are just used to be somebody's tool. We are the sportsmen, we're the singers and the dancers, and we're also labeled as the pimps and the criminals and the drug dealers and the killers and the vagabonds of society. We're the bogeymen of British society and other Western systems. And we want to dispel that lie and destroy those myths and put the black man back on the map where we belong. Who is the black man? The black man is the original man. If it wasn't for the black man, no other men could be on this planet. We are the fathers of humanity. We gave birth to all of you.
We are the watchmen on the wall. You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchmen for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is the people vote, but they don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend?
You can't do nothing for me. See, that's what we got to be careful of. We got to be careful of who we bow down to. But see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:07 here in the city of Philadelphia. Excuse me. And we're in conversation with activist organizers of UGMA's People's Progress Party. Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi is with us this evening, talking about some of their efforts down there in the city of Baltimore and surrounding counties. In fact, the whole state of Maryland. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Brother Brandon, Brother Nanda, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Elliot, can I raise two questions, I guess, before we go to the phones?
Certainly. Go ahead.
I'm just curious. You know, well, no, it's not a curious, Brother Brandon and Brother Namdi. I just want us to continue to, you know, communicate, educate the listening audience and even ourselves in the purpose and mechanism of a party and what is a party supposed to do, and the UGMA People's Party, Progressive Party, and what you men are launching out for us African people. And this raised a question I wanted to get your feedback on. Is a party formation a governance, administrative, and a policy development tool? I guess I'm asking, through the party, do the party help black people self-govern and administrate the needs, at least keep tabs on, identify what administration is supposed to do, and then help in the policy formation? Would you agree that that's what a party instrument does, and that's why it's so important for us to have an independent party?
Yeah, I'll speak to that quickly. So those are one of many things that a political party can do. I think going just a more traditional look at what political parties are, right? Political parties are instruments of class struggle in societies, right? Like that are divided. The political parties come together because people have interests that they want to be able to pull together. And the state the government itself allows you to pass policies and agendas, right? So that if you are tied to certain kind of economic interests, certain kind of social interests, you can fund them. You can give them more leverage, right? You can make sure that they have the best opportunities to move forward. And so we often think of the white community as being a monolith, but it in itself has all kinds of splits. There are hundreds of political parties that exist throughout the United States, some on the local level, state level, and several dozen at the national level. And they all have their differences about how white power should dominate the rest of us, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not a monolith. And so in understanding a political party, yes, it does help us galvanize policy, help us govern, because it allows us to be able to bring it all together and make it sure that it has a consistent message. It's a machine, right? It functions to do a job, and it outperforms individuals and small groups all the time because it's able to reproduce itself and its ideas over and over.
I think that's really important, and that point that you emphasized.
That was a great explanation, Richard. That was a great explanation.
Yes. You hear all the time about black people not being a monolith, right? And that's supposed to be some code word of why we are in a powerless position compared to that our diversity is not coordinated towards our interests, our specific interests, which can be done and the party mechanism do that. And this is my last question before you go on, because which raises an interesting question. We always talk about the dynamic duo, the Democrat and Republican Party, when we're talking about parties. From the perspective of Ujima People's Progressive Party, within the Black community, what would you say are the resources, the political resources that that is being competed for, and that's why, being competed for by other black political interest groups as you're formulating the party. Is there some things that you can see, and you mentioned the NGOs specifically. Is there other things besides the ones around the, prisons or dealing with crime that within black community that we who come out of looking for power, we would be competing against, which they're tied more to the Democratic Party, if that makes sense.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense, Reverend Richard. And I would say think tank and advocacy groups, political advocacy groups particularly, and I'm going to also hint back to what you said before we went to the break about the initiatives of defunding and funding police, the language, the culture, and how it is intricately tied to the think tank and political advocacy groups, which are also loosely fitted, or should I say interwoven within the political machine and plantation politics mechanisms of the Democratic Party as a tool. So when we're coming back to that defund the police question, the think tank and political advocacy groups, a lot of them, that you'll see with cool hashtags and nice dance and making characters of the struggle, but making it more appeasable to urban, suburban, youth and others who aren't exactly politicized to know what their class interests are or how it works in principle, particularly that this is a class struggle for economic interests, for socioeconomic interests of black folks as well. The defund the police measure would have a think tank advocacy group ask for 51% defunding of the police, where for us, we'll say no money. We'll say, in other words, defund the pig. And there's a difference. You say defund the police, we say defund the pig, because in that initiative, we wanted to be clear that although the budget that may be set in that language for think tanks and advocacy groups to say, well, you can redistribute the funds here and there, they're still going to speak to a point that does not shoot themselves in the foot, but also leaves the door open for nonprofit industrial complex to still exploit the terrains of seeing a city that is economically divided. Their social interests and political interests are at a total crossroads, and also knowing that the black community does not have any economic development, whether it is a black face in office, woman or man, or whoever for that matter, there's always going to be those disparities. So when we're talking about the defunding the police department, that language is one of them, that think tank and political advocacy groups, where they'll take a reforming step while also excluding the fact that, well, what about the city being under a consent decree? Where you talk about defunding them, their resources can still come from federal grants. We say, hey, defund them to 0%, no grant money, no anything, no new weapons, no new toys. And we also want to speak highly on that, on how political advocacy groups and think tanks become competitive in space, because if we're there to address the budget and also challenge the councilmen who are working in a clandestine way, where because of the COVID-19, that provides them an advantage to the community, over the community, to delegate bills, hearings, and discussions, it's the arrogance of the Democratic Party and also the loose factions of the political advocacy and think tank groups that coalesce and work in alignment that there isn't no parallel. They are working on the same strands and strings, because they'll be out advocating for a half measure or compromise that a city council government would be willing to hear, but they're not highlighting the fact that, oh, in black communities or inside of poor and working class black communities, we may not have access to internet to have Zoom to even know if they're having a Zoom meeting online. No one talks about that on that end, but the competition drowns it out, because when you have groups that are coming with resources where they're able to come with buses, tools to distract and deviate from the message itself, there's always that contradiction that combats with other black-led organizations that say, well, hey, what about the black workers? We still have black workers that's inside the city government structure, such as sanitation workers, that are affected by this because it's their children and family. What about the communities where we come from? So it becomes quite competitive in the language that one group says defund to a certain degree, the other says defund to 0%. And to bring it in closure, we want it to be clear that competitive factor is the difference between groups that make noise without substance and groups that actually are very full of substance and will be able to bring the noise when it's appropriate. So it's up to groups like Ujima People's Progress Party to be able to use that crowd to draw out the critical mass, get them politicized, organized through the Fannie Lou Hamer political education class, and involved with a serious structure that can take the fight from city hall to the state capitol and addressing the state legislature and the complete structure of the black misleadership class and all that stands in between the nonprofit industrial complex, using the Democratic Party as a shell to deploy the efforts of a political advocacy group and think tank against radical organizations that are organizing on the ground.
Thank you.
Let's go to the phone. Let's go to 602. 602?
Yes. Are you hearing me, brother?
Yes, sir. How you doing now?
Okay. I'm doing great, good brothers. I'm doing good. Let me see if I can take this phone off for echo, off of this echo here. Sorry. Just give me a second. Hold on. Just give me a second. Oh, sorry about that. You know, the other day I read a little sentence, and it said, by Mao Zedong, and it said, political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. And I look at America, and I look at black people in America, and all the different tactics we have tried to get some equity in this country. And I am hopeless, brother. As far as it comes to getting along with these folks here, I am hopeless. I am just hopeless, you know. And I think that we spend too much time trying to get along with these megalomaniacs. These people ain't going to change. All this stuff we see happening now, it is just to appease us. See, as I said, this is war, you know, and they know when to back up and they know when to advance. So when they see us strike, they say, okay, we back up a little bit. but they come back again. As you said, they're still shooting us in the street. It's not stopping. You know what I'm saying? So my solution is, if we connect with our motherland, the motherland, Africa, 12 million square miles of land where the mass majority of our people reside, and we begin to trade and do business with them and develop, I think you'll get a better response from these Europeans. Because what we are doing there, we're cutting off the economic support, because that's where they get their support from, you know. It's Africa. That's where Oppenheimer, that's where Microsoft, that's where Firestone Corporation, that's where they get their wealth from. They get their wealth from the motherland. See? They rob a dollar and give us a penny. Let us reclaim our legacy. And I think that if you see a mass movement of black people moving to Africa, you'll see more food stamp, more Section 8, more, they'll be giving out those of benefits. And they don't want you to do that. They don't want you to do that. They don't want you to make that connection with motherland. They want you to stay here and try to get along with us. Stay here and keep looking here for your salvation. When 401 years have demonstrated, if there was any relationship to be worked out, it would have worked out with us. So I think by us connecting with the motherland, it strengthens even a political party here, you know. But without us connecting with that connection, it's going to be running on a treadmill again with these people. Because these people are tricksters, you know. They're tricksters. They ain't been in charge of this place here for so long, being stupid. So they appease us a little bit, you know, to see and calm them down. You know, let them believe everything is all right, but we're still killing you. We're still shooting you. You see what I'm saying? So, me, as I said, for me, I have no hope in this place. No hope. You know, and maybe that's just me. But, you know, I just give up. I ain't going to even bother try to get along with the European no more. I am strongly looking to the motherland, you see? Right now, I'm looking to Gambia and Ghana, because by next year, I'll be getting the first thing smoking out of here, man. I'm sick and tired of this place. Anyway, good brothers, you take care.
Brother Marcus, stay with us a second. Stay on the line. Brother Nomni, Brother Brandon, any response to Brother Marcus?
Yeah, the struggle with connecting to the motherland is also rooted into global imperialism as we see it, where we talk about the 1033 program, the no treat, no retreat, no compromise, no retreat, and how the militarism of being divided by colonial borders and ocean waters is exactly how that global effect of Africans leads to the oppression no matter where we are. So being able to fight where you are and connect that fight with the homeland is also key. And I think that the brother expressed his sentiments on how the diaspora, but also the African totality, is definitely in need to be in arms with each other, and more than just solidarity, but in an effective nation building that puts us at a stronger capacity to not only say, well, hey, we don't want U.S. embassies inside of African nations to white colonial settlers that is inside of South Africa to be gone, to actually being able to overthrow those inside the U.S. who benefit from the settler colonial nation here, and white settlers having those resources that divides us between class struggles and economic interests. So when the brother was expressing that, connecting to Africa and being able to make this a global fight, we also have to realize that the effects of colonialism is what kind of drowns it out and also buffers it down to the point that it comes back to combating U.S. militarism and intervention abroad, as well as the domestic terrorism that is imposed upon black communities at home.
Yeah, well, we're saying the same thing.
Go ahead, Brother Nobby.
Yeah, so again, and I appreciate the brother's international perspective, because I think, again, that's part of the miseducation of African people, is that we're often instructed to fight as individuals and to not have a global eye to what's happening to African people throughout the diaspora and on the continent. We are openly an anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist and anti-colonialist party. And I think what makes that unique is that what we're trying to speak to is the whole system of white supremacy and how white power works. Oftentimes, when we are in the United States, because of the lack of real education, especially political education, right, we sometimes create exceptional answers about how politics works. Political parties have the same role in every nation of the world, right? The Democrat and Republican Party represent a high level of capitalist activity, but they're political parties all over the world. And so the struggle on the African continent is not a disconnect. And even as Africans go from the U.S. and from the Caribbean, go back to Africa, we have to be aware that neocolonialism exists in Africa, that there's a class struggle that has to be waged, that the misleadership class of leaders that run the state governments have no real control over the economic conditions and relationships of Africa. The United States, Europe, and increasingly China have all the real controls of the economic situation, and that ultimately we're responsible wherever we are for defeating imperialism and creating a world where African people can live, you know, in self-determination and as human beings.
You know, can I say, you know, add on to something that, in agreement with everyone, you know, as it relates to a party. I'm like, really, and you'll hear me constantly probably say policy, policy, policy. And I agree. I agree with Brother Marcus in the sense, well, everyone, of our need, you know, to create in our party formation that we should have a foreign policy position that centers us strictly in relationship to, you know, the African continent. And in my arrogance, I also, think that, besides us dealing with our own internal, you know, especially of us in North America, as we create our party formation and deal with our internal contradictions, we have to provide the linkages, because power is now global. And we as African people, our local power will, I believe, and y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, will depend on our international tie with the African continent and the African states. And yeah. But the reality is, they have, in relationship to when you put it in the framework of Western European capitalism, they are dealing with that contradiction also. So we have to help them navigate while we're learning how to navigate and be able to create the linkages, because that provides the cultural relationship, our economic relationship, and our political power. And it is not going to be something simple, but I think if we don't create policies in our party formation that intentionally does that, then we're in this moment we're putting ourselves behind the eight ball, you know. And that's so even though that's my projection, that the importance that our party formation has a foreign policy position instilled in it, centered on the continent, but recognizing there's internal powers relationship that the continent is currently in. I mean, a lot of those class leadership parties are tied to Western European, whether we heard about the French and the British, you know, those in South Africa. We have to help so that we, you know, create that alignment, I believe, that is clear, that true for a true African power position.
I see.
Brother Mark.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, go ahead. Make your point, then I'm going to finish up. I'm going to kind of piggyback on the other man.
No, in reference to capitalism, socialism, communism, I don't know what type of economic system we're going to put in place when we come to power. But whatever economic system we put in place, it has to make sure that every black man, woman and child, his house, his clothes, he's educated, he's protected. See? So I don't know what type of economic system I said, because, you know, some people complain that, you know, your socialist loafer shouldn't get nothing, shouldn't benefit from it too, you know, because you have people who like to loaf too. So the loafer, you shouldn't benefit from the work, and but everybody has to contribute in this. But whatever system we put in place, we got to make sure that all our people are provided for.
Yes, yes, I agree.
And Brother Marcus, let me wind it up by saying this, because I heard what you stated, and I heard Brother Namdi and Brother Brandon and Brother Richard, and I just want to kind of echo their sentiments, because if you're talking about our people going back to the continent or want to be back home to the motherland, you're still talking about political moves. We have to be organized. When we had the ambassador on, Arikana Chinaboro-Kwayo, and she talked about the sixth region, she was talking about brothers and sisters in the diaspora, but she was talking about the need for our people to be organized. And that's a key, because the same fight and struggle that we have here, you heard Brother Namdi and Brother Brandon talking about the Black Misleadership class. That's the same fight that the brothers have on the continent to get these people out from in front of all of our people. They're not meeting the needs of the people. They're catering to white power. They're black faces on white power. So the struggle that we have here to take control of our affairs is the same struggle that we have on the continent. See, I think that some of our people get a little twisted when you hear brothers and sisters talking about getting involved politically. Certain brothers and sisters talk about getting involved politically. They're not talking, these brothers here, they're not talking about they want to get involved politically so they can be the next John Lewis or the next Barack Obama or Elijah Cummings. They're not talking about that. They're talking about meeting our people's needs in these communities where we are and where we pay taxes at. The people's needs is not being met. And the people, these black faces that are in so-called power, they're not meeting the needs of the community. They act like they are, but they're meeting other people. They're catering to other people. That's so, right. I mean, what we're talking about is political organization, to be honest. I just wanted to make mention of that, because I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you.
You're correct. You are correct. It is one system. It's one global system. It has, they have their local flunkies here, and they have the international flunkies here. You know? So it's one whole system, and the whole system got to get turned over. The whole thing, but you see, you know, it's coming. Something is coming. I don't know what the hell is coming. But something is coming. A change is coming. And we see it already. So, you know, the next 5 years, the world might not be the same thing. May not be the same, because it's cracking. It's cracking even in my country now. The people rising up and shooting police left and right. That never happened before. So, you know, it's spreading worldwide. So, you know, it's... Look, it is what it is, as they say. Anyway, good brother, thank you so much. Please keep on keeping on. Thank you for the program.
Talk to you soon. Let's go to 404. 404? 404? Atlanta, Georgia, 404? Let's put them back on hold. I don't know what's going on there. Let's go to 267. 267?
Jimmy Elliott.
Yes, sir. I hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, man. I listened to the conversation, man. But, brother, okay, I asked you what I asked Ocean and everybody else. Okay? How long will they kill our prophets and we stand around and look? Okay? Even that situation will happen in Atlanta. I'm not in Atlanta right now, but last Friday, okay, at that Wendy's, when that brother was fighting them two police, niggas was standing around looking. Okay? We got to nip this stuff in the bud soon as it happened, man. Okay? That's where I'm at right now, bro. Okay, y'all sound good, eloquent, talking, kitty cat, kitty cat, kitty cat. in the real world, man, especially in the hood. Now, if you out there in the middle of the country on the expressway, that ain't the time to fight them, okay? But inside the hood, like that thing happened in Atlanta, bro, that didn't a little white girl burn down windows, man. They got a little white girl burn down windows. The brothers filmed that, okay? They did good on that. But when this thing first jumped off at that witness, when they stopped him, when my man, they woke him up, they were doing good with the conversation. And then next thing you know, they in the parking lot rumbling, two against one. That's when the folks should have come out and get out their cars. People sitting in the damn car too, looking. Okay, people, that's the hood right there. Okay, that's when they should have stopped it, when it was two against one. All right, that's how you got to do it, bro. I hate to say it. Y'all sound good, eloquently talking. And I say, I'll hook up with the black farmers. And right now, bro, Elliot, I'm through talking, bro. I let somebody talk, man. I love y'all.
Talk to you.
You know, Elliot, it's a question that brother raised that you know, that was one that specifically I would like Brother Nammy to help us with in relationship to Baltimore. What is the power of the FOP in Baltimore City politically? I mean, as a political influence, you know, in the electoral politics and the power politics of Baltimore.
It's a very powerful political organization. Most of the police officers in the Baltimore City Police Force are not residents in Baltimore City. There's even a fraction, a good percentage of them who actually are residents in Pennsylvania that live in York. In lower parts of Pennsylvania and commute. It has a lot of influence, not just around being able to fund candidates, but it has influence in the ear of the local politicians because of those donations when it comes to policy. They've intervened in things that are not even necessarily political at face. You know, Brother Eddie Conway, who was a political prisoner and a member of the Black Panther Party in Baltimore, spent 27 years in prison, I believe, 29 years in prison. Every time he came up for parole, the FOP had a major showing, right, every time he came up for parole to try to ensure that he would never be able to be released. And so it exerts its pressure all over the place. There is an attempt now by progressive and revolutionary unionists to try to get the FOP, all forms of the police unions, kicked out of the AFL-CIO. It's not a popular position yet, but it's growing. The truth is that they don't really function like a true union to protecting worker rights. They're partners of the ruling class, and they function as an arm of the state. And the FOP and the different type of benevolent organizations that support, that represent police interests, are really the think tanks, right, of how to advance police tactics and strategies locally and nationally.
Thank you.
They have to be smashed. It has to be clear that any political party that represents black people, they cannot, you should never make any contract negotiations with the police. It has to be smashed.
And, you know, I didn't want to go, but, you know, I think that we must, even when they're talking about, it's interesting that the discussion that you raised earlier, Elliot, that is being put on the national stage about defunding,
mm-hmm.
when it's really that FOP as operating, and Brother Nami, you made it clear, operating as a alignment to the state. And I mean, even the black misleadership class, the silence they have, that as I understand it, y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, the silence they have is because, not just because of the coercion of them being law enforcement forces, but because of the political contribution that they provide in dictating to them what they will and will not address. So here, as we see these incidents out of the police department all over the country,
where we have all the, I mean, you're seeing also all these black mayors, all these black police chiefs, and there is no power to deal with the FOP,
mm-hmm.
who has been pushing the policy to get the funding to militarize, to even, to, so that, you know, if we as voting citizens, I don't care what party you're in, but especially in progressive parties like the Ujima People's Progressive Party, if we don't see that that is a major enemy, no, competitor that we have to defang, I don't think we understand power politics in America.
Yeah, I think also it's that's a good example of challenging how black people at all levels relate to politics. Unfortunately, for most of us, politics is voting, right? Mm-hmm. Or politics is protesting.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is that when we really think about what political organization looks like, it looks like the very mundane things, right? It looks like the connections between your black association and your community associations to programming, to the boys and girls clubs.
Exactly.
All of these are extensions of the Democratic Party. You know what I mean? All right. The financing, all the opportunities,
mm-hmm.
the education programs. It's some of it is the most benign forms of interaction that black people have, but we don't understand we're interacting with organized parts of the state, you know what I mean, organized parts of political parties. And so when we start to think politics, we have to think about how do we build institutions? How do we educate? How do we fund? How do we raise money? We, you know, too many times we show up at City Hall on the day of the vote, but there was no preparation 3 months, 6 months, and actually, you know, contesting the whole idea, the whole policy from day one. We have to kind of transform how we interact with politics for it to have any real benefit, even in the short term, for our people.
Yes. Let's go to 267 again. Let's try it. 267, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to New Bern, North Carolina. 252. Let's go to 215. 215, are you there? 215.
Mm-mm.
It must be having a little party or something. What's going on? Let's go to caller. Are you there? I don't know what's happening with these lines here. Let's go to 646. 646. 646. New York City.
Greetings, brothers. Greetings.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, how you doing? This is Maurice Carper calling y'all from Black Men Screaming, the TV show in New York.
Yes, sir.
I find the conversation to be enlightening, and as usual, I do have a couple of the points that I would like to make, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I don't know how we don't connect the military-industrial complex to the police. This whole idea of defunding the police. First of all, I want to know who decided that that's where the push of this movement was going to.
Mm.
I've been watching the news for the longest time, and I'm like, how the hell did we get here to defunding the police? How did our whole movement get defined as that's what we wanted? Because nobody damn sure didn't ask me, and I've been in this game for as long as I've been alive. Nobody didn't ask me a damn thing about it.
Well,
the problem I have, let me get this out. The problem
ahead.
I have also is the lack of respect that's being paid to brothers and sisters that put the hard time in the streets and did all the hard work before all of these other people just jumped up and decided to march out in the street. You need to respect the elders that put the work in, because not all of us are dummies and stuff. Some people actually were there. You know, I stood in the vestibule, my brothers, when Adolf Leader got shot, and I fought for years, going back to Eleanor Bumpers coming forward. So don't disrespect my time in the game, because all of a sudden the media is paying attention to you. I don't give a damn about the media. What I give a damn is about the community. And when we talk about Africa also, I mean, you just look at a small issue like Lesotho, right? Lesotho is where the majority of marijuana comes from. Yet you have the Chinese in Lesotho dominating that particular country, whatever, and not even allowing black farmers in that country to even participate in selling marijuana and stuff. So when we talk about Africa, let's not forget about the Chinese, because they're in there doing all the same things. It's a different philosophy of capitalism, I guess, and it's all right if the yellow people do it, but the Europeans do it. Let's not be hypocritical on that particular issue. I know the brother raised it before, and I called in on that. I'm angry over this whole stuff because I don't see how the military don't get connected to this. This whole thing is, you said it's systematic. You're 100% right. It is systematic. But let's start thinking on the logical. And last point, and I'm going to shut up and I'm going to get off. Operation Breadbasket. People forgot about that, right? Do anybody remember Operation Breadbasket?
That's what
Dr. King and I went to Chicago and stuff. They started talking about Operation Breadbasket. Jesse Jackson took that over or whatever. They had agreements with these corporations in terms of them doing the right thing in communities and all of these different things. And then they reneged on it when the pressure was let off. People have to understand that we cannot allow them to sign agreements, do all these different things, and then the pressure is let off of them. We have the history there. These people think they care with these ideas. There's people have been thinking about this stuff for years. Go back and watch Tony Brown's journal before it was Tony Brown's journal. When it's called the Black Journal, when you had all these black leaders and stuff that sat there and they talked about this stuff 50 years ago. This is nothing new. Damn it, and it's part of our own responsibility and our own fault because we didn't teach our young people that we have creators and thinkers and all that. My nephew got in an argument with people online, at least white people kept talking all this nonsense about, where's the black leaders? And you know what he said? And I was so proud of him. He said, you killed them all.
Right.
You killed all of them and you imprisoned them all. Now I'm shutting up. I'm getting off now.
And we have to, I mean, you bring up a real great critical point, because even the party's formation of that time, the 56 years ago, is because that leadership was killed off and imprisoned. And others had to leave the country. You know, that's what left that vacuum. But what is being characterized now is that black misleadership class. They became the reason why they were reneged on, because those guys, even in that moment, and I keep using 72 in the convention of 72, they decided they wouldn't go down when you had all the interest groups together in a national formation. And I'm going to use Gary as a pinning point. You know, the origin of the Congressional Black Caucus, which later, you know, those few black political leaders now goes into the thousands of black political leaders and others that are at bureaucratic levels and administrative levels. It's those guys who decided they weren't going to uphold those policies, whether it be about at black history in the schools, having public, local public health centers. These were policies that were formulated by that leadership that you're talking about, that these other guys decided that they weren't going to do. And I think both of the brothers raised the point in using Baltimore as an example, where that nonprofit group came in, which created another layer of how they can funnel the money to pay off people not to provide the service that black people needed. Not that we didn't have the will, not that we didn't have the plan, not that we didn't have the leadership, that was intentionally disrupted. So, and I think that we have to take that in consideration.
Yeah, but you're exactly right. What we're going
to
do?
Can I speak to that brother's statement as quickly as possible?
Oh, no, take your time.
Yeah, I think again, I appreciate the issue that he's raising, but we have to understand things. And we have to understand things holistically, as he was trying to say, right? The ideas themselves aren't new, right? The fact is that every generation has built upon each other generation as far as advancing these ideas. One of the problems that we have about the kind of leadership that we have today, the misleadership class was given to us after our revolutionary and radical leadership were murdered and run out of, you know, locked up around the country. And so we have to ask ourselves, what kind of institutions have we left for young people? Young people are going to learn ideas. If we have not built the kind of institutions, whether they're political, economic, or social, that teach these ideas, then young people come to them as though they are new ideas that they discovered themselves. And the lack of respect for elders is because elders weren't tied to those institutions, right? To pass on the kind of, not only the information, but the wisdom that comes with what to do with that. I want to point this out, and I hope people can research this. When I was a younger organizer, I lived in Tampa Bay. I lived in a city called St. Petersburg, Florida. And in 1996, if anyone remembers, there was a brother murdered there, and it was a rebellion that lasted several months. And it had ups and downs and highs and lows of that as well. There was a political organization that had been in St. Petersburg, Tampa Bay area since the 1960s. Many of those organizers were part of SNCC, and they continued as an organized force, as an institution, buildings and campaigns that had never stopped. And they were center of the struggle for the justice for the brother, Tyron Lewis. And they were able to orchestrate something very, very unique. Groups like NAACP, SCLC, other kind of civil rights groups could not take the lead because this revolutionary organization had established itself as the most dominant political organization in that area. And all the slogans, all the ideas, even the coalition that got built came as a relationship to this radical political party. We have to start asking ourselves, what kind of political leadership have we put in place so that when crisis happens, because it always happens, are we in place to lead the struggle? Other contending forces, the white people, the poverty pimps and sellouts, they're all going to have their hands out. But if you have a revolutionary organization that's in the middle, in the center, that can move itself to the fore, right, it can set the terms and push everything to the most radical extremes as possible so that the community can move forward. And the last thing I'll say is that off of that struggle, it took 10 years in that city before another shooting of a black man occurred in that city. It can be researched, and you can find the answers that kind of organization is what we need all over the country.
Wow. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back and our time left, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're with activists, organizers of UGMA People's Progress Party, Brother Namdi and Brother Brandon. Get involved in the conversation while it's still here. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, ibibitumitv.com, ibibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. ibibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. ibibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometz U Black family, to join your interconnected Kometz U Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. ibibitumi.com, ibibitumi.tv, ibibitumitv.com, ibibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
Take it easy, brother. Brother X on the line.
Oh, thank you, my good brother. Brother, I admire your knowledge and courage. And we might not always be on the same page, but we are definitely in the same book. Do you listen to an internet show come out of Philly called Time for Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard?
No, I haven't heard of that. It's good?
Time for Awakening, man. It's a great show. But anyway, in between they breaks, man, they play clips from many of our black leaders of the past. Malcolm X, and they play Rosa Parks. Anyway, Dr. King, they play these clips. And I would hope that maybe the station would think about doing that sometime instead of some of this music. They even got a clip of Fannie Lou Hamer when she was beat by two black guys in the jail. She was beat with phone books.
Yeah, yeah. I played that clip myself trying to get people to come out to vote and see what people sacrifice.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. And a lot of our people haven't heard these people talk. And it would be good to hear that.
Then I have an obligation to tell the truth. Let it transcend generations. Release the frustration of these cameras that watch. Break time constraints of these Gregorian clocks. Face fears that's embedded by the media. Fix food, right or wrong, it's like a tedious. Been eating this for so damn long. You about to get it, everybody ain't gonna listen. Even make the effort. You've been looking for a savior or a shepherd instead of heeding the message that the ancestors left us. After unlearning what you have learned from those concerned with preventing your evolution, the insatiable desire to know self will dissolve illusion after illusion, illuminating deception and darkening perception. Red pill ingestion, skill set perfection. Power begins at the level of conception, so we conceive of new relations, new villages and new nations, dismissing traps and bridging gaps from conception to creation. In the absence of belief, there lies knowledge. Applied knowledge plus time equals wisdom, forming new paradigms from old systems, ancient values, future vision. Decode the message in this transmission and use it as your ammunition. Because whether or not you make it is strictly your decision, should you choose to accept this as your mission.
People keep waiting for something to come down from the sky to bring their freedom, help them see themselves in a better light. But it don't work that way, my friend. But when for change is offered, then when what we need is to transcend the path of freedom lies within.
cause everybody's not gonna make it. You want your freedom, you gotta take it.
Everybody's not
we need that red, that black, that green for liberation. Freedom's not free, freedom is taken.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and it's 9 o'clock straight up here in the city of Philadelphia. In our time we have left, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. I think it's a call up here. Let's go. And caller, what's your name? Where you calling from? Caller, are you there? Let's put them back on hold.
Hey, Elliot, can I ask another question before you go to the next caller? I want to see what Brother Brandon and Nandy think of this from their vantage point.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and that is, you know, do you consider this moment, this period with COVID, the riot or the rebellion, the economic turndown, that black people are in a more political crisis than any other time or any other time in your organizing experience? Is this moment a moment of a political crisis for black people, as you see?
Brother Brandon, I think we lost you. You still there? Brandon? Brother Nami, you might have to pick up the baton there.
Yeah, okay. So do I see it as a political crisis? I think the black community is in a perpetual political and economic crisis. I think periods like this expose that crisis in a way in which people like us have been telling people this is the problem, and we are often told that we have either extremist ideas or overblowing it. But now the crisis, which is the same, right? It has black men have not been stopped. The murdering of black men and women have not stopped. The incarceration of black men and women have not stopped. The breakup of black families, the unemployment, none of that has changed. So the truth is the crisis is as it always has been. I think the heightened awareness of that crisis is what's changed. And that's why we have so many people in motion right now.
Brother Nnamdi, and Richard mentioned this COVID-19. We're still in the middle of a pandemic. The situation in Baltimore, now I'll draw a parallel to Philadelphia, which is similar to Baltimore. Black elected officials in almost every strata of office, beside the mayor, and prior to him, you had about three black mayors in a row. But the commissioners, the city council, the sheriff, all these positions are black. And the COVID-19, according to statistics, was hitting our communities much harder than other communities, white communities also. But it was no testing being done among our people until a consortium of black doctors got together, called themselves a Black Doctors Consortium, and was going around to churches in our community giving free testing to any of our people that wanted it. Is there any type of thing going on in Baltimore? Is any of our people being tested in these communities where we're being hit hard?
So there are no organized efforts, especially from the people themselves, to do that. I think the epidemic hasn't been as bad in Baltimore City. There's actually other sectors of Maryland where that has been really, really hit. PG County is, again, which has a much larger black population. We see huge numbers of deaths and infection rates. Testing has been available to our community slowly but surely through some of the stuff that the state has had provided, but there's no proactive testing happening, right? People can go in, and you could always go and get yourself tested if you thought. There was funds for that, but there is no proactive attempt to try to figure out who's sick and who's not.
Okay. You know, that kind of just kind of goes along with the things that Richard's been pushing about the need for us to have some type of public health policy among our people, our community. I think there's a little construction going on in where Brother Nnamdi is. Brother Nnamdi, let me go here. This might be Brandon getting back in here.
Yeah. Brother Brandon. Yes, I just got in. Mm-hmm. I just got back in. I'm sorry. I got cut off.
No problem. Go ahead. You wanted to say something in reference to the question that I'd asked about the, or did you catch it?
I caught the question. I thought I was answering it and I was heard, but I didn't. So I was saying that it's a teachable moment, that the pandemic crisis itself is no different than other ways of oppression, biological, medical, or any kind of form that was used to brand the face of what can happen if one group used medical racism, environmental racism, or other forms to be able to say that, hey, we are the endangered. We are the ones who are causing the issues, or more importantly, we are the ones that will be underfunded, unprotected.
Brother Brandon? I think we lost him again.
Yeah. One of our platform positions is community control of health. Mm-hmm. To address the disparities, but I also think it's not just about addressing it. It's the way in which, unfortunately, I mentioned Reverend Annie Chambers at Douglas Homes. She had an older brother who also lived in public housing, who several weeks ago attempted to go to John Hopkins Hospital, which is world renowned. He was not feeling well. John Hopkins turned him away, and he knew he wasn't feeling well, so he started to walk to the next nearest hospital, which I would probably say is about 4 or 5 miles away downtown Baltimore. He collapsed on his way there, was picked up and eventually taken to the hospital where they found out he did have COVID-19.
Okay.
Unfortunately, he passed several days after being, on the life, support systems and all that. He ended up passing. So part of the problem that we also have is, as Brother Brandon was going into, is the way that health is even treated, right? If you complain about health issues, we're undertreated, treated too late. And so our rates of death from treatable, curable diseases are high. So we have to have control of our health system so that when things like that happen, we have practitioners who respect our community. We might have to also include holistic health, not might, we need to include holistic health in part of that, because most of the U.S. healthcare program is a for-profit driven program. It's not a health system, it's a sick care system. So we have to really challenge all of that in the way we understand policy, and not just waiting for the elections to do that, but to help create those community-based projects that go out and can be proactive.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. And if I like to build on that and saying, we have to also make sure we centered it as another part of our economy, that, you know, the career tracks that has to come out of that, the products, the health products that come out of that, the things that come out of dealing with our health that directly relates to us. We have to look at it as building those things is a part of our political economic economy. And if we don't, then we're looking at somebody else serving us. So the educational process, because in order to have those healthcare workers that directly service us, we have to produce those healthcare workers. That means our educational system has to provide the skill, the worldview orientation and the skill sets of the students who go through it in order for them to take on those careers so that they can be able to come back and provide service. I think, you know, sometimes when we talk about it, and I'm glad that, you know, the party has that as a platform, that recognizing that is a part of our political economy.
Brother Nnamdi, and kind of concluding things for this evening, I know things have been disrupted because of COVID-19, where you couldn't get together, and probably the this year's convention gathering has probably been disrupted. So I guess you've been doing a lot of things online, or how has it been as far as organizing, you know, this year? Being able to capitalize on some of the things that's happening now as far as galvanizing the people, how has it been?
Yeah, so definitely we've had to make the switch to using, you know, the internet and being able to do online conferencing, political education. We do our community meetings that way now. We've been able to continue our relationships with our national allies. We were just several weeks before COVID-19 shutdown, we were already in the process of planning our state conference, being in end of July, early August. Timing wise, it was going to be after the Democratic National Conventions, after they have their national convention. We wanted to have our own response to that convention, right? So we've been trying to build that and make that possible online. That's something that we've expanded now. We've been contacted by radical elements in the labor movement that want to have that discussion. The condition, obviously, is that they support an independent black working class party, and that's not up for debate with any of those folks. So we'll be putting some information out soon about that kind of discussion and the role that the black liberation movement has to create the kind of institutions we need, not only for electoral process, but for our own national liberation. And we're doing that with partnership with.
Oh, lost Namdi's call. I guess he'll call right back. Because I wanted him to kind of give out the information where people could get in contact, things of that nature. Richard, the you know, I'm glad we have the brothers on. We're gonna swing back around and get some of the other brothers on, that Zaki Baruti from the Universal African People's Organization. Get Khalid Rahim on from the New African People's Party. Maybe Brother O'Malley, Yeshiteli from Black is Back. Get them to Brother Namdi is back. Brother Namdi?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
So I don't know where I left off at, but I was just saying that we were planning a conference, and we still have one lined up.
Okay.
For the end of July. We're going to send out information. We've been working with brothers from the New African Independence Party. Brother Rahim, Talib Rahim, is in part of that discussion. We've opened this discussion up as far as being in working with other activists who would like to see a national labor party. That's workers from the unions and from community organizations, from national liberation movements. And people like Brother Khalid has been really articulating well that there will be no a workers' party, labor party, that dominates black liberation. We will have our own independent parties. That is not a question, right? Either we have our own independent parties or we don't discuss any national movement like that.
Great, great.
Brother Namdi, the one other question before I get you to give out any information as far as how people could get information or contact or things of that nature. What the Fannie Lou Hamer political education classes, what is usually the age range of the young people that or the folks that have been, because it might not all be young people, the folks that have been interested? I mean, just curious.
Yeah, sir. Usually the age range looks like young 20s, mid-20s. We have several comrades who call in their 70s. So it's a good mix. You get a lot of good experience. We have a curriculum that really helps dig into the history of black independent political struggle, Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party, the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, Freedom Now Organization out of Detroit. There's just a whole wealth of information. The National Black Independent Party work that Brother Richard had mentioned earlier, studying all of that so that we have some answers and can learn from our own history.
That's so important. So important.
before we wind up this evening, Brother Namdi, give out any information, how people can contact, how they can get information, any literature, things of that nature.
Yes, yeah, certainly. So people can always find us on Facebook, which is really interactive for us. It's UPP Maryland, Ujima People's Progress Party Maryland. You can also find us online at www.uppmaryland.org. You know, we put out videos, we put up postings, especially if there's mobilizations, we like to share as much information. We believe it's necessary to build a network and not just be focused on just what our organization is doing. And to that point, a lot of people have had some really helpful ideas today. We're not projecting that if black people get involved with political organization, especially around electoral politics, we are not suggesting that that is the solution. It is a part of the solution. The true answer is that black people must be organized, and we must be organized around our own interests. There's nothing that individuals, no matter how much experience, how great our oratory skills or organizing skills can do, if we're going to solve our problem, it has to be an organization. And those organizations have to have clear, defined goals and objectives so that the people can unite with us, you know, when it's time to move forward.
Brother Namdi, I want to thank you and Brother Brandon for being with us to give us updates on what's been going on down in Baltimore and with the party. And the door is always open to you, brother, to come on and, you know, give new information if you have some updates, things of that nature. You know that you can always reach me.
Thank you, brother. We appreciate the solidarity and love sharing the information from all around the country.
You know what? Brother Richard had an idea about some type of round table coalition or coalescing with some of the other black independent parties. We're in the process now of trying to formulate that, but I'll be in touch with both you and brother Brandon to see how you want to move forward in relation to that. I've already talked to Khalid Raheem.
It's past time.
Okay.
It's past time. Good. We need to do that.
Good. All right. We'll talk soon, brother.
Thank you, comrade.
Take care. Everyone, now.
Continue your struggle.
Peace.
Yes, sir.
Richard.
Yes, sir.
Interesting conversation with the men. They're down there working. They're organizing. And that's the thing, man. They're active. That's what it's going to take. You can't sit around. And, you know, I heard Brother Maurice call up. And, you know, it's kind of funny. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the program about our people being into control of this narrative and where it's going. When he mentioned about nobody came and asked him about, you know, some of these narratives that's coming up, defunding the police and others, and where is it coming from? Now, to be honest, you know it's not coming from black politicians.
Right.
So, you know, that's all I'm saying. We have to be in control of where these narratives and where this thing is going. Because what's behind it is the historic generational murder of innocent black men and women and children that's been going on in this country since we've been here.
Right.
So we can't let other people and other objectives and other lifestyles take control of what's going on and what's been historically happening to our people.
And I think that becomes, you know, it was important in how that the conversation and, you know, these conversations flow, because I just want to add, you know, terms. I guess I'm always throwing out terms in the sense of we have to be clear about scenario building. Because what we're, you know, and recognize that's different than what we're seeing. Because as you say, somebody, that's a coordinated effort, a propaganda coordinated effort to be able to put a policy position on the table without actually putting a policy on the table. Right? That's what they did, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they told us, and it's interesting because in one session I was in, there was, I heard one commentator, well, in a session I was in another discussion, political discussion, and they shared with us a brother who was looking at the organizational process called the Hydra, which was used in Haiti and in Suriname, I believe it was, where you had many heads, right? But there was no leadership. They're coming back telling us, this is the media, you know, the instrument of the state is telling, they can't determine who's leading, right? So who is leading the, which means that we can't determine who's put out this message that, and I think I appreciated the analysis that you gave in the sense of how it shift from in this whole thing of defunding, who's involved, who benefits. And I think Brother Namdi and Brother Brandon brought it up. In defunding it, who gets that funding? Who and whose interest that defunding benefits? Well, if it don't benefit Black folks, it's benefiting other folks,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're hearing that policy that wasn't put in policy in a policy process is being considered, and they're talking. I mean, mayors, and even up to the national is considering defunding, which only means taking out some of the money in the budget that goes to the police department. They ain't saying where they putting it at, but they're saying they're considering that. But these other folks, somebody put that out there. Black folks ain't put that out there.
Exactly. That's what I was talking about whites, rights in these cities now have gentrified these cities. Traditionally, and in these cities, a lot of the resources was going towards the police. Because, I mean, we were living in like a small police state, basically.
Yeah. And if, as some say, that it was an exercise for a minute, it was a military police state.
Okay.
Right? Okay. In Philadelphia, 52nd Street, they were lined up in a Black community, you know, throughout the Black community. They ordered the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So first you had the police, and they told the police to stand down and let the military be there. Now, it wasn't like while showing us the people who were doing it, the people who might have been doing quote-unquote looting might have been Black folks, but the people who were destroying property was not Black folks. That's what they showed us. I mean, I might have, you know, I just see clips. I mean, you know, so for those who were watching, you know, the news, you might have seen some other folks, you know, I don't know, you know, and you know, when you see clips on the internet, you don't know if that's real or not. But from what I got, a lot of that stuff was young white folks that were doing that.
Or at least provided the apparatus to bust these store windows and things of that nature.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they. In fact, here in Philadelphia, that was true. I don't know about other cities, but
this power of organizing, but of us getting control of the narrative, you know, but we can only get control of the narrative when we're presenting a more developed narrative of our own, and that's what I'm considering. You know, projecting that we're calling a scenario. Well, what is it that we looking for? What is it that we want? What is it that we want the grandchildren to have based off of what we're dealing, the great grand to have based off of what we're dealing with now? No, we are still organizing. We're still, you know, developing a policy. But if we don't communicate in that forward thinking, because we didn't hear those, you know, that came, and you know, that came out of think tanks. That came out of universities. Somebody wrote a book about it. It's a book on policing, and in there, defunding is a part of it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like this ain't no just come out of there nowhere.
Oh, certainly. That's why I said that sometimes. That when these folks get together, if we're not organized, we end up playing checkers and they're playing chess.
Mm.
Because you don't see white folks out here marching in these suburban areas have police departments. I ain't seen no marches in these suburban areas talking about defund the police. Mm. It's going on in these urban areas and especially cities that's been gentrified because right. they want these resources allocated differently now. It's no need for all these cops to be in these areas now where all these whites are because you're not there. And that's another thing, too. They move in these communities. It's not like you get people coming from hillbillies coming from the hills of West Virginia and all moving in these communities, Richards.
No.
These are supposed to be liberal whites that's moving in these communities. Mm-hmm. But they don't want you. Exactly. But they don't want you living there. They want you out of there.
Right. Hey, look.
And they figure they don't need all that heavy policing anymore. They want these resources reallocated. They want dog parks for their dogs so they can walk up and down. They want those rec centers cleaned up and refurbished so their children mm-hmm. can play in them. They don't want all that glass and all over, the grass uncut, the bathrooms you can't use, the basketball and the swing sets and all is all in disrepair, falling down. They don't want those centers like that anymore. It was like that when you was there. And when you complain to your elected officials, they claim they ain't got no money. Because the money was going other places, and they probably had the money, but they wasn't spending it on you. But see, right. now these whites moving in these areas, they want those resources. They want those monies allocated. And if they allocate it to the police, they want to defund the police so they can have the money. They ain't interested in you having no money. They ain't interested in your children being educated or you having jobs or anything else. It ain't. I don't see how people think it's some kind of epiphany that fell over white folks in a matter of a couple of weeks that they're interested in your life or black life or matter. Are you kidding me? I mean, why is our people, all of our people ain't fools, but some of our people are going for this.
And it's interesting. We had, Brother Brandon and Brother Namely, because as, started in the questioning, just five years ago, Baltimore was in the same, around Freddie Gray, right? That was only 5 years ago, Elliot.
Yeah. Well, Richard, if you remember, now the Democratic Party is introducing these reforms.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the first reforms I read was eliminating chokeholds. Now, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, Richard, it was either after Rodney King, one of the controversial slayings. I mean, these slayings happen all the time. In fact, I was going to read some of the ones that was done by the Malcolm X coalition when they did that report. But I think it was after, and some of our listening audience know better than me, I think it was after Rodney King when they outlawed the chokehold, if I'm not mistaken. But these companies still been doing it. These police departments still been doing it. Half of them is under consent decrees to obey this, that, the other. That consent decree is almost as good as somebody having toilet paper to use it to wipe themselves. Now all of a sudden they want to outlaw chokeholds. Chokeholds was outlawed in New York. It was supposed to have been, but Eric Gardner was killed with a chokehold.
Mm-hmm.
After, I think it was after, not Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, well, I think it was Tamir Rice, it might have been Michael Brown, when Black Lives Matter came on the scene,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and you had real activists involved early on. I ain't talking about how it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the legislation that came out of that was the body cams.
Right.
But you see, half of these officers, they don't even have the cameras on. They don't have cameras. You know, come on here with all this stuff about some. Come on.
Look,
come on. Listen, when you go in town, Richard, black folks don't want nobody playing three-card Molly. They, you know, you see people playing it and they come up. Come on over here. It's a bunch of junk. It's a scam. These people playing three-card Molly on black folks, and some of us are going for it.
Mm.
And really believe these people are sincere. Let's try to grab one more call before we start winding things down, Richard. Let's go to 215. 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, how you doing?
All right.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm crazy to do for a lot. I just want to say I enjoyed the interview with the two brothers from Baltimore, because just like us in Philadelphia, Elliot and Richard, they got their hands full down there with white racism and white supremacy, police brutality, gentrification, you name it. You know what I mean? Black folks all across the country is pretty much catching the same thing. But it's just ironic, brother. You was telling Brother Richard just now about the how we got to stop going for this shit, for this flea car Molly to show and tell with all some of these whites so concerned now. Because I was talking to Brother Shamari on the terrestrial radio station, and he said the same thing too. He said we got to be brighter than that. He said he took the position not to. He said white folks really serious. He said to stand up against this government. Like I always said, you really serious. Don't just march with us. Go to your white racist legislators, your parents, whatever. If you really sincere, go fight them. You really that sincere, you want to see change, don't get out here and show and tell with us in the streets with this show and tell. Then you go back to your suburban home, whatever, and everything is fine. Fight against those racist bigots, your racist uncle or that police department who you know is a cold-blooded bigot. Fight. If you doing that, then I can give you props and say you sincere. But just to be out there marching with some black folks and stuff, then you go back to your suburban home everything is fine to me. Like you said, it's BS, man. Like I said, you're really serious. Take the fight to your own white racist people. That's what Malcolm told the white girl back in 60-something. He said, go back to your community and deal with them bigots that you live with. Then that shows me that you're really sincere about helping black people. But you know, Elliot and Richard, I know y'all ain't got too much time, but you know, when you look at how white folks say things, it's so... They say stuff that with such, I guess I'm trying to find the right word to say this, Ellen Richard. They say stuff with such certainty because it is real and their history is what it is. And stuff like, for example, I was listening to National Public Radio early in the day. And a white boy was talking about how that old racist prime minister up there in Canada, Brian Mulroney, you know, he's the one, Ellen and Richard, as you know, he was wearing blackface, you know. He was caught with blackface several years ago. And it's amazing how these white boys like him, the Virginia governor, they love to have blackface. I guess they say that was their Michael Jackson moment. I mean it's just these people, they joke, man. Anyway. Yeah,
well, Michael Jackson, he hadn't had a blackface since he was a kid. Go
ahead. Now, y'all need to stop, man.
I got to steal that from Elliot. I got to steal that from Brother Elliot. I got to steal that one. That was a good one, Elliot. I got to give it to Elliot. That was a good one, man. But anyway, they come with this blackface of nonsense. But anyway, Brian Rooney had the nerve to sit there and say, well, you know, America has the problems of systemic racism, and we here in Canada too, because you don't get a lot of press, Ellen Richard, but Canada has their share of black men being murdered by the police. Just recently, two black men over the last month got murdered in Canada. One in Toronto, where they had a mass demonstration, and one in another part of Canada by the Royal Mounted Police. So we see clearly white supremacy is all over, like Brother X would say, they're all over the place. And anyway, the white boy was saying that Brian Mulroney, if he was sincere, he would have quit after he got caught with blackface, so he should have resigned his position from the from being Prime Minister of Canada. But see, the thing is, Elliot, the white boy played a clip on National Public Radio about how this white legislator was saying about how we as Europeans, he said it like he was saying it like you and Richard was saying, y'all going to Adiola's for dinner. He said it with sex glee. Oh, well, we as Europeans, you know, we came into the United States, we came into America, we did the same thing in Canada. We killed and murdered and committed genocide against the indigenous people, and we ain't giving it back. We did it. We don't care whether it was fair or unfair. We took the land. We murdered the inhabitants and everything, and we did it, and we did it by brute force. And when he played his clip by this white boy, the white boy said it like it was no big deal. And see, and I say all to Ellen and Richard to say, this is the mindset of these people. They see nothing humanely, from a humane standpoint, a moral standpoint, about killing people and taking their land and stuff and their resource. They see nothing wrong with that. You see the same stuff over in Israel right now with them Zionists over there who are a number of fake Jews that went over there and took the land from the Palestinians with the help of the United States, Britain, and all of them. They see nothing wrong with going around to people's countries around the world, whether it be the Americas, whether it be Palestine, whether it be Canada, which was, you know, the land that was formerly known as, before Canada was called Canada. They see nothing wrong with this, murdering the natural inhabitants of the land, taking their resources. They see nothing wrong with that. To them, it's like a rites of passage. And see, and I say to Ellen Richard, let our people know, this is the mindset you're dealing with. This is the mindset you're up against. This is the mindset that our people, we like you said, Ellen, we're in a dreamland. If you think you're going to sit there and these people going to fundamentally change, if they're that callous and can just sit there and say, think it's okay, like it's a walk in the park to murder people, commit genocide and take their land, rape their women, and they don't think nothing's wrong with that. The Crusades, I mean, we just go on and on with the stuff that these people have done and still doing. Go over to Libya and take out Gaddafi, take the resources over there. I mean, they want to do the same thing in Venezuela as we speak. So if these people's mindset is so wicked, for us to think that we can live in peace with these people, it's a facade. It's never going to happen. That's why you say, Ellen Richard, we have got to, as a people, have our own self-determination. These little handkerchief-head, boot-licking Negroes that supposedly part of black, you know, leadership, that want to stay with these people and want to live among them, let them do it. But we as right-thinking people, we have got to do all we can to get land for ourselves, whether it be land in America separate from them or land somewhere else. But we definitely at some point have to get away from these people and let these people be, because we have shown time and time again, we cannot live in peace with these people. It's just not going to happen. People with that kind of mindset, Ellen Richard, you just can't live with them in peace, man. And that's not no hatred. That's no anti-Semitism. That's just a fact of life, brother. You cannot live. Anytime you can sit there and shoot a brother like they shot the brother in Atlanta, they shoot a man in the back and don't think nothing wrong with that. I mean, come on, man. I mean, you know, the man, brother, running away and it taser, you're going to shoot him in his back twice and you think that's okay? And some white folks think that okay?
Yeah, well, I didn't know that a taser was a deadly weapon. I thought it just stuns you and knocks you over.
Well, that's what the brother on the TV was saying. This brother, he's a current police officer. He wrote a book about police brutality. He was arguing with the European over there on Fox News about a few minutes ago. He told him, he said, look, man, he said, this is why you have such mistrust among the black community. Because I find it hard to believe that these officers would have took the same attack had it been a white man. He even started a case recently where a white boy took a taser from an officer. He was struggling with two white cops. He took the taser from them. He was struggling with them. And guess what, Elliot? They took him in alive. They didn't beat him up. They got him. They took the taser. He wrestled them. He took their taser. They got him down the ground. He wrestled the taser from him. It was a struggle. He was getting his licks in. They got some in. But the bottom line is that they got the taser back from him, and they put they handcuffed him in a forceful way, but they handcuffed him. But the point is they didn't take his life. They didn't shoot him. And he was up close. He was trying to use the taser on them. He just couldn't get it, you know, the thing where this brother, he's turned around, but like the brother said, the black cop said, Ellie, had he even tried the taser, it wouldn't have did anything. The taser, you have to be right up on a person to do damage. So with that brother pointing at the cop, it wasn't going to do nothing to him if he had been able to fire it, because it wasn't going to do anything, because you have to be when you taser.
The bottom line, he seen his opportunity to kill a black man, and he took it.
That's right. Exactly.
You got a guy that was clearly, when they showed the video, it looked like he was inebriated or drunk.
That's right.
They gave
him
the breathalyzer, and he was drunk. In fact, he asked the guy, are you going to take me home? I don't know whether you saw the video. He asked the cop, are you going to take me home? And he said, well, we're not going to take you home right now. And that's when they start turning him around to handcuff him. You got two officers supposed to have been trained. Are they supposed to be trained professionals? And you got a man that's drunk, take two guys down? Come on, man.
He took
two guys down and then took the taser from one of them. These fat, out of shape, all they want to do is shoot somebody. And shoot somebody, you know, when you watch those old Western shows, when you shoot somebody in the back, you was a coward.
A yellow belly, yep.
You're going to shoot a man in his back after he done run off with your taser. You should be ashamed of yourself. You ain't nothing but a chump. You got two guys and a drunk man take both of you down? Come on, man.
It reminds you of Walter Scott. You know, Walter Scott.
Listen, that's sorry to say, because it looked just like the Walter Scott. The guy wasn't running all that fast. You know, he was drunk. And, mm-hmm. and just like Walter Scott, he wasn't running all that fast. That guy just took aim and just gunned him down.
Gunned him down. We didn't have to because Walter Scott.
And I can understand the frustration of brother West had called up because, you know, when they show that video, Richard, you don't watch mm-hmm. the television. It was people in that. It was people in that drive-in line.
Yep.
Because they showed the cars sitting there. I mean, how can you sit there and watch? You know, it'd be hard to sit there and watch something like that. Just watch a man get gunned down after something mm-hmm. like that because he fell asleep in the drive-in. And, you know, what's all this stuff? You fall asleep in the drive-in line, so you call a cop.
I know.
Just
I
like
know.
this Arab guy up there in Milwaukee.
In
Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. When Floyd mm-hmm. supposedly gave him a fake 20, he calls a cop. And so, I mean, I don't know how he bought his goods if it was a fake 20.
Exactly.
If you're doing what you're supposed to do, the person don't get out the store with a fake 20. You hold it
exactly.
up, you run the mark over and say, hey, brother, you can't get anything with this. And you give the money,
exactly.
man the money back.
Like I said, in Brother Floyd's case, he, like I said, whether he's dead or not, it don't justify what happened to him. It's 90% chance, like I said, he might even not know it. Because, like I said, that happened to me. I was downtown a couple of years ago, right there at Jefferson Star. I was buying a train ticket. And I didn't know because, you know, I go from stores to stores doing shopping. And I gave the white girl the $20 bill. And she, like, marked it. She said, sir, this is not a bill. And I said, whoa. And all she said was she said, you know, things happen. She said, I know you can get bad money. Because I told her, I said, miss, I wouldn't have known it was a bad 20. I said, it looked like a regular 20 to me and stuff. So anyway, she said, no, I know things like that happen. So she just gave me the 20 back, and I just went in my pocket and in my wallet and got another 20 out and gave it to her. And that one was good. I mean, you know, things happen. He may not even have known. It might have been passed to him by mistake because things happen. Like I said, unless you got some kind of an eagle eye, you can't look at a $20 or $50 bill and tell that it's a counterfeit or not. That's why they give you that marker. That's why they run a mark over it, because it's hard to see out of the naked eye. Again, unless you got a trained eye, it's like an eagle, man. So Brother Floyd might even have not even known it was a fake 20. But whether he did or not, the bottom line is that you don't, like you said, Brother Ellie, you don't call no police on nobody. Like all the clerk had to say, well, sir, this is not a real 20. I can't accept this. And that's it. And give him the 20 back, and that's it. And move on. But you don't call the police on nobody, not like that. You know, come on, man. You know? I mean, this is insane, but it's how these white how people think they weaponize the police when they come to black people. White boys can commit all kinds of crimes and things like that, but nobody weaponizes the police. But when it comes to a black man, a young black girl could be selling water, like I'm gonna let you go on this, Ellen Richard. Young girl in Oakland selling water a couple years ago for her church, and old white heifer, she called the police for an 8-year-old black girl for selling water. I mean, come on, man. I mean, this stuff is so. Oh, man, it's just out of pocket with these people, man. And we think we can live in peace with these people. You can call the police on an 8-year-old girl, black girl, that's selling water for her church and stuff. If you got that kind of mindset, Ellen Richard, is it any wonder we have reached this moment in time that we are in now? If you can do that to an 8-year-old child, if a 12-year-old boy like Tamir Rice don't even get a chance to lay down his toy gun and the white cop come out the car shooting, just come out blasting a 12-year-old child with a gun, a toy gun at that. You know, don't even stop to see whether it's real or not, or tell the young man to put the gun down. He just comes out blasting. I mean, come on, man. You know, brother, you're talking about a demonic mindset. If that's not a demonic mindset, I don't know what demonic is, brother, you know. But I know Ellen Richard, our brother's pressed with y'all to, you know, wrap it up. I just want to thank you, Ellen Richard, for giving me the time, man, express myself. And, again, I enjoyed the interview with the two brothers from Baltimore because, like I said, just like in Philly, them brothers, Lord knows, they got their hands full down there like we got our hands full up here in America dealing with these fools and stuff up here. This white racism and white the demagoguery and bigotry and whatever else you want to call it, you know. But thanks, Brother Ellen Richard. Good show as usual.
Talk to you.
Take it, Brother Ellen, Brother Richard.
Yeah, Richard, it was another incident that happened Thursday in Los Angeles. According to published report, 62-year-old man killed in his own living room by the cops.
Mm.
And he was disabled. Supposedly he went for the gun, you know, the same old thing. He went for the officer's gun. And he was called to the property because of a disturbance. Somebody called there because, you know, he's, I guess he was getting a little out of control. It was a verbal argument, according to the published report, with a woman who he lived with for 21 years. It says, wait a minute, let me read some of this, Richard, if you got a minute here. This is, wow. L.A. cops shot dead an unarmed 62-year-old man in his living room, claiming he was reaching for the deputy's gun, while the victim's family insisted he was turning away from the officers when they killed him, and said if the man was white, he would be alive. Michael Blue Thomas was shot and killed in his home in Lancaster early Thursday morning when L.A. County Sheriff deputies were responding to reports of a domestic dispute. According to the cops, they shot the disabled man when he tried to take one of their firearms. Michael Thomas Blue, pictured here. They got the picture here. Cops slammed. The tragic shooting unfolded around 5:30 Thursday when police responded to a 911 call made by Kimberly over a domestic violence incident. Police said she later told them that Thomas had assaulted her. When the deputies arrived and tried to detain Thomas, the man refused to comply and a struggle broke out, according to authorities. Thomas then reached for one of the officer's gun, according to authorities, at which point the officer shot him. During the altercation, the suspect reached down and attempted to gain control of the deputy's firearm when the shooting occurred, according to the police statement. However, Thomas's family denied the allegation and said he was not reaching for the gun. The cops just murdered him. Thomas's distraught fiance cast doubt on the officer's claim that Thomas reached for one of his guns, insisting that he was simply turning away from the officer when they opened fire. The victim's family are seen at the home where the disabled man was gunned down by cops. They broke the front door down and grabbed Mr. Thomas immediately. Said his family members to, said family members to the reporter. As they were holding him, they hurt him by twisting his arm. At that point, because he was uncomfortable, Mr. Thomas tried to move, and one of the deputies just stepped back and shot him.
Mm.
He was murdered without justification. It was 100% avoidable. Thomas reached for the gun, reaching for the gun is completely false, and pointed out that he had disabilities to his hands. He was disabled and he had problems with his hands. It was painful for him to try to grab and hold anything, let alone a gun. He said that Thomas did not own a weapon and was only having a verbal argument with his fiance, who he lived with for 21 years and is mostly deaf, meaning the couple talks loud to each other all the time. The victim's fiance was devastated, as she told CBS Los Angeles. The reports that Thomas had reached for a firearm are untrue. So we see here the same thing going on, Richard.
All the time.
Reaching for a gun, 62-year-old man in his house. According to reports, he's disabled. They do acknowledge that. But when they try to put the handcuffs on him, he reaches for a cop's gun, and they shoot him in his own living room. So, I mean, we can see that this stuff is really ending. These people are sincere about what they're talking about. You done had three murders since George Floyd didn't been laid, been funeralized. What happened yesterday, this incident that happened Thursday, and then the brother in Louisville that was protesting Breonna Taylor being murdered, the restaurateur that was shot out front of his place by state troopers.
Mm.
And probably more. That's just the ones we know about.
Yeah.
Richard, the struggle continues. That's all I got to say.
It definitely does.
Before we wind up the program this evening, just want to give you the lineup for Time for Awakening Media on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting dialogue and conversation on African Perspectives. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on Monday evening, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. From 9 to 10 on the first and third Mondays of every month, Conversation Reparations, which is in Cobra's program. It's on from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. They double back on Saturday with two programs. The ladies host Black Reality Think Tank on Saturdays from 4 to 6, and then the elders speak. Black Reality Think Tank, the elders roundtable, which is 6 to 8 on Saturdays on Time for an Awakening Media. And then Friday, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. Be some new interesting programming starting next month, Richard. I'll kind of billboard some things. One of the programs I'm really excited about, I'll kind of leave it up in the air for the listening audience to get excited with me when they finally hear about it. But I don't want to say until we kind of get everything squared away. But I think the listeners are going to be pleased about some of the new programming. Two new programs that will be coming on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. A lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the play such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman.
save the children. To save the children.